It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And the subject for today is really the path is right here, right before you. What you do with your conduct and with your relationships and your work, everything that you do and how you do everything that you do, that's your path. And that's the subject for today. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Those are Dogen's words. And it's so true. We forget that the path is right before us. It's right here. And so different ways of saying that is really what this talk is all about. There'll be two wakas, and the first one is called, there's a title, Realizing the Way Upon Seeing Peach Blossoms. Realizing the Way Upon Seeing Peach Blossoms. And it's only four lines. Blown by the spring wind, peach trees in full blossom, without any doubts, extending branches and leaves. Once more, blown by the spring wind, peach trees in full blossom, without any doubts, extending branches and leaves. So Okamura Roshi comments that this poem comes from a famous story of, I'm not going to say the last Chinese name, it's too complicated, but Lingwen, one of the Dharma heirs of Guishan. And Dogen introduces this story in the Shobo Genzo fascicle, Sounds of Valley Streams, Colors of Mountains, as one of the examples of insentient beings expounding the Dharma. So in this case, the peach trees in full bloom, extending their branches and leaves in the spring wind with no doubt. That's the Dharma. And we'll explicate that. So Lingwen had been practicing the way for 30 years. And once while he was walking, he sat down to rest at the foot of a mountain and he saw a distant village. And it was spring and he saw peach trees in full bloom and he realized the way. And he composed a verse to offer it to his teacher, Guishan. And the verse is, for 30 years, I have been looking for the sword. How many times have the leaves fallen and the branches grown anew? Since seeing the peach blossoms, I have no more doubts. So he saw the peach trees fully blossoming without doubts. And he realized the way. So looking for the sword refers to a story of a person whose sword fell in the water while he was riding in a boat. And he marked the side of the boat where he lost the sword. And another person said, what are you doing? And he answered, I'll look for the sword when the boat reaches the shore. So his actions make total no sense. And Lingwen compares his 30 years of practice seeking the way to someone who loses his sword overboard and yet searches for it on the shore. So the sword is already, you know, miles away. And Lingwen's searching, during his searching, the leaves fell every autumn and the branches grew every spring. And he had not realized the way was right there where he walked and where the flowers bloomed. The way was right in front of him, but he hadn't noticed, and he was looking everywhere else, maybe like us. In the Shobogenzo fascicle, Buddha Nature, Dogen says, the roots, stem, branches, twigs, and leaves are equally the Buddha nature, living the same life and dying the same death as the entire being. In other words, we're all interconnected, living the same life and dying the same death, and as the whole entire being, which means that we can learn from anything. It reminds me, this is, you've heard this before, it reminds me of Suzuki Roshi once saying at Tassajara, the way to study Zen should be the way a fish picks up food. It does not try to catch anything. It just swims around. And if something comes, snap. So that's another way of putting it. Without trying, we can get something. Just living and paying attention. So Suzuki Roshi continued at that point, and he said, some of you may remember this. Even though it was very hot, you were observing, even though it is very hot, this is at Tassajara where he's talking, you were observing Tassajara rules, eating in the hot zendo like a fish swimming around. And if something good comes, snap. As you were doing so, you will get something. I don't know whether you realize it or not, but as long as you are following the rules, you will have something. Even though you don't have anything or study anything, you are actually studying, like a fish who doesn't seem to know what he's eating. That's all. We should study Zen in that way. To understand does not mean to understand through your head. So he said this to Tassajara students who were at the time living and studying Zen Buddhism at Tassajara. But what he says doesn't just apply to monks. We're all basically swimming around. And if the rules are in place, that is, ways to live and go through your day without wasting time, so we're also studying, and rules are not the point. The point is the teaching that the rules catch. That's the point. When you follow rules, you're in your own rules. These can be your own ideas about how your day should go each day. And then as you follow them, even though you think you're just following your own rules, you'll get something. True understanding does not mean to understand with our minds. And just to go back to the old, to study Zen is to study yourself. This who am I? That's the essence of Zen. You go through your day, and we all have our day. And if we pay attention, we learn who we are, not with our mind so much as our whole being. It's the body, actually, with its body intelligence, that graduates the school. So a monastery sets up a day for you, but you can set up your own day. Then you go through it like a fish swimming around, and if something good comes up, snap. The willpower to do this, however, to follow your own day, go figure why, but it requires training. It requires training to follow our own day regularly, and to have faith in our own day, the one that we set up for ourselves. We've talked about this really important point of training. And it can be a school, it can be the army, it can be a music conservator, conservatory. It can be a job, anything that has a program that must be followed above and beyond personal preferences. That's what training means. A program that we follow above and beyond our personal preferences. And that training, among other things, will train willpower, which you can use to make your life precisely what you want it to be. So I'm just saying that I use a monastery as an example a lot, but it's just an example. Once you're trained, you go through your day like a fish swimming around. And if something good comes up, snap. And as you're doing so, you'll get something. And as long as you're following the rules of your own day, you'll have something and you'll know that you have something. Because everyday life has a Tao, a way. And if you don't practice in the midst of it, there's no approach to the true way. So, I mean, just, it's really, I mean, you could say it's really easy. You learn who you are, you set up your day so that you will accomplish who you are, and then you just follow your day, and that's the path. So the pointing out instruction of this waka is, the way is right where he walked, where flowers bloomed, leaves fell, and new shoots appear. But we have to notice. And so for Lingwen, forget the pronunciation, the sudden seeing of the peach blossoms, fully blooming, having no doubts. They just bloomed, no doubts, changed his life. But the peach blossoms had always been there every year doing the same thing with no doubts. So he just had to see it. And another waka on the same theme, but adding a critical element, it's called activating the mind without dwelling. And the poem is, water birds fly away and return, leaving no trace. Even so, they do not forget the path. Once again, water birds fly away and return, leaving no trace. Even so, they do not forget the path. And Roshi comments that the expression, activating the mind without dwelling, in the title means that we should keep our minds functioning without attachment to any objects. And yet, our mind should not become lifeless. So we're not attached, and we're also active. So activating the mind without dwelling means without becoming attached. We activate the mind and we move on from thing to thing. So in this poem, Dogen expresses a fundamental characteristic of bodhisattva practice using the analogy of migratory birds. They fly amazingly long distances each year without leaving any trace, yet they never forget the path that leads to their precise destination. And they transmit this path from generation to generation. I mean, this is just like Buddhism. So in Shobo, in Dogen, in his fascicle, Only Buddha Together with Buddha, he wrote, also concerning birds flying in the sky, there is no way for animals walking on the earth to know the birds' tracks. They cannot follow the bird's path by seeing their traces, even in their dreams, because they do not know that there is such a path. They cannot even imagine it. And yet, a bird can see the traces of hundreds or thousands of small birds having passed in flocks or the tracks of so many lines of large birds having flown to the south or migrated to the north. So the pointing out instruction for this poem is bodhisattvas are free from attachment to objects, and yet their minds do not become lifeless. So one of the objects bodhisattvas are free from is their own life. In this regard, I'm going to tell you the story of Zen master Dongchan's passing away. So if you remember when I talked about the later Zen master, Yunyan, who failed three times with three of the greatest teachers in China. Yunyan was the teacher of Dongchan, this person we're going to talk about now. And Dongchan established Chinese Soto Zen. So you've heard this before, but now we used to be talking about Yunyan, and now we're going to talk about Dongchan. And so just to let you know, this story is part of a whole genre of Zen masters playing with their upcoming deaths. So another way of saying this is that they know they can pick and choose the time of their deaths and the means of dying. Zen masters can do this because that's what master means. Master means master of oneself. And some of them show off a little bit when they decide they're ready. Not all, but some. So here's a couple of stories. The basic story, as told by Taigen Dan Leighton in his book on suchness called Thus, Just This Is It, relates how Dongchan had been unwell. After some discussions, he bathed, put on fresh robes, struck the bell, and announced his departure to his assembly. Sitting upright, he began to pass away, but his disciples wept loudly without cease. Dongchan opened his eyes and chastised them for lamenting and for attachment to life over death. So, because remember, life and death are equal and contain each other. So now his own disciples, who should have known better, were like lamenting over his death. So he intentionally delayed his passing and arranged a delusion banquet to appease them. So from one perspective, although Dongchan criticized their delusions, he still provided his students a feast with which to celebrate delusions. Okay, so then 7 days later, after providing a festive last supper, he told the monks that they had made a great commotion over nothing and asked that this time they do not make a noisy fuss. Then he sat still and passed away. So he used as a teaching his ability to control the timing and manner of his own death. Other Zen masters, including Shakyamuni, did this too. Dongchan was just a little more dramatic. Prior to this possible hagiographic exaltation of Dongchan, the story goes that a monk inquired of Dongchan, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who is not ill?" When Dongchan said that there is, the monk asked, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" Dongchan replied, "I have the opportunity to look after him." The monk asked, "How is it when you look after him?" Dongchan said, "Then I see there is not any illness." So even unwell in his last fatal illness, Dongchan is looking inside himself after the one who is not ill just as Yunyan, you remember, remembered to know when there was that there was one not busy, even while he was fully engaged in sweeping up the temple debris. So Yunyan knew inside himself, as he was sweeping the temple debris, there was one not busy. And Dongchan, as he is dying, knows that inside himself, there is one not unwell. There's not any illness, one who has no illness inside himself as he's dying. So a commentator on that dialogue I just read to you, when Dongshan said, "Then I see there is not any illness," says, when the ancients were about to go, they frolicked in the realm of old age, sickness, and death. But, he says, Dongchan was unusual among them. But even he could not surpass in eccentricity the disciple of Mazu, whose name was Wutai, who, seeking to be unique, died while standing on his head. So Dongchan, in dying, turns the situation inside out by caring for the one who is well. The one who is well is the one inside us, who is perfectly well despite our external circumstances. We all have one of those. We all have one of those inside us, perfectly well despite our external circumstances. Of course, awareness of eventual mortality greatly assists full appreciation of our life and death, of our healthy time. Dongchan's concluding statement is that when he looks after the one not ill, he does not see any illness. Wangshan, the commentator, says, this is where everyday practice empowers you when you're dying. The training in attending fully to awareness of life allows a calm awareness of death. Then even death is not an illness, but an expression of the wholeness of life, which it is actually. As soon as we're born, death is involved immediately. And as soon as we die, life is involved immediately. And so they're just different sides to the same coin. But in our culture, in our society, we are so happy when someone is born, and we're so sad when someone dies. But these teachings are saying we shouldn't be dwelling on one side or the other. So awareness without attachment. After this exchange about one not ill, Dongchan recited this gatha, which might be taken as his death poem, as no later one is given. That was a common practice at that time, to for Zen masters for sure, and poets always, to and poets were often Zen masters also. They left a death poem. And here is Dongshan's. Though the students are many, not one is enlightened. The mistake lies in pursuing the paths of others' tongues. If you want to be able to forget physical forms and obliterate tracks, work hard to diligently walk in the void. So that means in the emptiness, and that the whole thing means do zazen. But I'm going to read it again. Though the students are many, not one is enlightened. The mistake lies in pursuing the paths of others' tongues, what other people tell you to do. If you want to be able to forget physical form and obliterate tracks, work hard to diligently walk in the void. So here Dongshan says that none of his disciples are awakened. You know, I think that's a, if you're the teacher and none of your disciples are awakened, I think that's, goes back to the teacher myself. But inasmuch as they are still, so he says that none of his disciples are awakened inasmuch as they still pursue some path described by others. They're still looking out, they're still looking outwards. Through such pursuits, seeking a path to some future destination, they have separated themselves from full presence and awareness now. Like just what I said in the beginning, the path is right here, right before you, right here, even as you're sitting listening to this talk. It's right here. In the last two lines, Dongshan suggests that to let go of the forms of this life and freely enter death, one must proceed and practice sincerely, even amid the emptiness beyond material forms, that is, Du Zazen. It was after reciting this gatha that he prepared to pass away, only to be forced to postpone the event for a week by his wailing disciples. As we mentioned last week, Shakyamuni Buddha sternly explained to his wailing disciples when they heard of his plan to pass in a month's time, so Shakyamuni told his disciples that in a month he was going to die. And then when everybody got upset, he said, everybody who has passed, everybody who was ready to enter nirvana had entered nirvana already, and everybody who was able had laid down the causes and conditions for entering nirvana. Therefore, there was nothing left for him to do. So there was no benefit for these wailing disciples to have him remain with them. Before Suzuki Roshi died, he did a really similar thing. He didn't explain it in that way, but he told his disciples not to be concerned. And he said, I know who I am. That was how he put it. And I tell you these stories to raise the bar of our discussion about right here, right now, the importance of our management of the quality of our attention at all times, in all activities, cannot be exaggerated. Let it be the utmost. So here are some of the most important points. The first one, the way to study Zen should be like the way a fish picks up its food. It does not try to catch anything. It just swims around. And if something good comes, snap. And that's such an important teaching. It's all about waiting for the world to offer us its gifts as opposed to trying to take things. And it also, this idea of just swimming around, it's almost like no one's looking at the clock. You know, they're just swimming around. And I've hate to wear a watch. I've gotten to hate it more and more, because I just want to be what I'm doing. I just want to be with what I'm doing, and don't tell me what to do. Like many people are saying, don't tell me what to do these days in COVID. But I feel like watches distract me from being present, like a fish swimming around. And if something good comes, snap. It's a very important Zen teaching. The second one, water birds fly away and return, leaving no trace. And even so, they don't forget the path. And third, we're all basically swimming around. And if there are rules in place, which are ways to live and go through your day without wasting time, we are also studying. To understand does not mean to understand through your head. So we swim around, and we swim, and there we just go from one thing to another. All the rules are in place. We don't even have to think about it. And that's the way we should live. And we don't have to understand anything through our head about that. We just, didn't he say, follow our day like a mule or an ass? And then fourth, all of us could be looking for the sword in the wrong place. That's a real warning. We all might be doing that. Even though when we tell the story of the man who did that, it seems like, oh my God, he's stupid. But could be the description of everything that we're doing. And then fifth, everyday practice empowers you when you're dying. The training in attending fully to awareness of life allows a calm awareness of death. And we're actually told this by teachers who are preparing to die themselves. And then even death is not any illness, but it's an expression of the wholeness of life. And lastly, the importance of our management of the quality of our attention at all times, in all activities, cannot be exaggerated. Let it be utmost. And then here are some points for your reflection during the week. This idea of not trying to catch anything is really profound. And even though a fish lives that way, we human beings find it very hard. And even if you understand and even if you agree, you probably fail to accomplish this many times daily. It's basically the idea of allowing life to come to you and offer itself to you, rather than going toward it and taking it for yourself. And so for your reflection, please give an example of both, of when you allow yourself to let life to come to you rather than you go to it, and the opposite, when you take from life and you kind of take instead of give, of let it give. You take before you let it give. So both behaviors, please give examples of both behaviors in your life. Because we all do the taking, and not all of us do the letting life give to us. But I think actually we all do. Try to think of when. And the second, give an example of one day in your life that you have set up and then followed like a mule or an ass. Give an example of that day that you've set up in your life. And if you haven't already, maybe you could use this as a chance to take a stab at it. Take a stab at setting up your day without wasting time in your day. The third is, how would you grade your willpower? So let's define willpower as the ability to do something that you have decided to do despite your personal preferences of the moment. So willpower is to do something that you've decided to do without giving in to personal preferences of the moment. That's willpower. And use grades like they do in school. And if you get a B minus or lower, you might consciously devise a way to increase your grade. Because willpower is a key ingredient for Dharma practice. Since you must have it, you have to find a way to get it. So this is a really important assignment. And also you may say, well, I have tons of willpower. So great, that's great. And then you can become conscious of when you're using it. And you might even develop an even stronger willpower. Fourth, this idea that in everyday life there is a Tao, a way, and if you do not practice within it, there's no approach to the true way. So I wondered if you could talk about that, the Tao in your life, in your everyday life, and your happiness in the midst of it, and your ease in following it. And if you don't see one, and are not happy and easeful in the midst of it, what changes might you make in the direction of changing this for the better? So the fifth one is Bodhisattva practice is not to bring our minds to a halt. In fact, Suzuki Roshi said we should always be thinking of new ideas and new ways of doing things. So give an example of the last new idea you had to do something, the last new idea or way to do something that you've had. And describe your reflection as in front of this mirror of how often do you have new ideas or new ways to do things? Describe yourself in terms of this. Am I someone who I always have new ideas and I do things differently? I accomplish the same task in a different way always. I'm always creating new things and new ideas. Or it could be I'm kind of stuck. And I just do the same thing every day, the same way. And I have for years. So you may be that person. So that's the reflection question. And these, by the way, just as a reminder, these are posted on the website. So you can refer back to them easily without re-listening. And ideally, you will answer them in writing, because that's the best way to integrate these teachings and to fully digest them in writing. And then from there, you can remember, you can refer back to what you said, and you can start incorporating your answers into your conduct. That's all for that. I wonder if you have questions.
So the first one that we have is, I don't really understand, rules are not the point. The teaching that the rules will catch is the point. I'm not getting how rules catch anything. They just seem like rules.
So rules provide something for you to look at other than your personal preferences. So they leave out, they allow you without thinking to just swim around. And then because they hold you, they've told you what to do already. So you don't have to think about that. You can just swim. And then if something comes along, you catch it. But in following them mindlessly, your body learns something. And what it learns is the real lesson of right here, right now. It learns, this is the path, even though I don't understand it with my mind. And it bypasses your mind. And in taking that out, it takes out your small self. And it gives you a glimpse of your big self. So what rules catch are your big self. And since Zen is about studying the self, naturally, monasteries are set up so that you can see your big self actually all the time. And I encourage you to do this if you haven't already, because it's a way right in your own house to see your big self. And it's not that hard, and you'll save a lot of time. Okay, that's my answer.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question that we just got is, you have often mentioned things that cannot be understood with the mind. When I try to do this, it feels like acceptance. And by just accepting without critical thinking, it feels like understanding. My question is, how one can verify this understanding? With the mind, there are various ways of confirming truth. But is it possible to do so without the mind? Or are things understood without the mind always true?
I don't think the mind ever verifies the truth. It only verifies facts and information. But the reality of our being cannot be seen by the mind. So the mind is not able to verify that. And verification usually comes from a teacher. I think that also, so for example, in the story that I told today, the first waka of seeing, of realizing the way upon seeing peach blossoms in full bloom without any doubt. And then that person like realized that that's the way. And then he gave that poem to a teacher, and the teacher would verify that he did understand the way. Number one, that's why the having a teacher is emphasized so much in Zen practice. But I think for this question for you, I want to say that the way verifies the way. And how you will know is how easily you walk through your life. You will know by the ease and in a way, simplicity of whatever it is. I want to say that the way verifies the way. And so you just need to be able to recognize that. But we all need to be able to recognize that, just like the poem said, seeing the peach blossoms in full bloom, who didn't have any doubt. That made him recognize, oh, I need to live exactly that way, seeing my path right before me without any doubt. Doubt, by the way, is a big, let's see, there are, I think it's called afflictions, that in Buddhism, there are five afflictions. They're called the five dull afflictions, and they're greed, hate, and delusion, and pride, and doubt. So in other words for that is greed, anger, and delusion, arrogance, and doubt. So pride or arrogance and doubt. Those are called the dull afflictions in Zen practice. And there's another five called the sharp afflictions. I can't remember them, but one of them, the first one though, is seeing, you know, seeing yourself as being real, because none of us have an authentic, real, independent self. Then if you believe you do, that's the first sharp affliction. But I don't remember the rest of them. But anyway, doubt is considered an affliction. It's like, let's just say, real problem. I've said enough. Just remember, in all that, if you didn't understand, try to remember the way realizes the way. And you'll know it, actually. You'll just know it. You'll just recognize yourself, your real self in it. That's your authentic self right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Next question that we have is, I have been thinking a lot lately about the peach blossom moment in my own practice. I don't know whether the experience is necessary in Zen practice. Even though we don't strive for anything, that seems like a goal. Have you had a peach blossom moment? Or are those experiences simply a series of deeper and deeper realizations? Thank you.
You know, I'm going to answer the second question first. We are always, so long as we're practicing, we're always deepening our understanding, even if we're not aware of it. And sometimes we deepen our understanding little by little, and then all of a sudden we realize how different, let's say on your birthday, let's say that's a good day to reflect how you were last year on your birthday. And you see, oh my God, vis-a-vis Zen practice, I'm an entirely different person. But if you hadn't reflected on that, you wouldn't have even noticed that you're an entirely different person, that you've gradually, just by practicing, grown in understanding without knowing it. And I think I'm participating right now in a, it's called the Genzo A, Genzo being Shobo Genzo. And it's from Okamura Roshi, and it's like an intensive. For 4 days, he talks for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon. And then on the fifth day, just 2 hours in the morning. So already this morning, I've had 2 hours of wonderful teaching. And he says, even now, And he says, I'm 74. Don't believe anything I say about the Dharma because I'm always growing. And next year, I might say something entirely different about the same passage in Dogen. So don't stick to what I'm saying. Tomorrow, I might say something different. I think that's an example of how gradually we just grow and then we realize it by looking back. But in terms of peach blossom moments, you know, I think that that I have had a couple, but I'm forgetting them right now. I just remember feeling that of, oh, like, oh, that's how it is. That's what it feels like anyway. Like, oh, that's how it is. That's what it felt like for me. And I wish I could give you my examples. I'm sorry, I just can't think of what it was. I just think it's happened a couple of times, but, you know, no big deal, sort of. It was just like maybe a stronger, instead of this kind of invisible learning moment by moment, it was a little bit more visible, but it's still just learning moment by moment. Thank you, though, for that question. It was a good question.
Thank you, Gail. The next one we have is, I didn't know that Zen masters can choose the time and means of their dying. Can you say more about that?
Well, again, they're masters of themselves. And all of us, it's my understanding anyway, that all of us have a known lifespan. And I once went to, I was given this as a gift to visit to a Tibetan astrologer who specializes in this kind of thing. And he told me in my chart how, you know, when I'm going to die to the day. I mean, he did tell me. Knowing's one death, it seems like, is just a part of the wholeness of life. But what I really want to say is the teachers, you know, once you're a Zen master, every single thing you do is a teaching for your students. You don't make a move without it being a teaching for your students. And they're looking carefully. So when a Zen master is going to die and they know it, you bet they're going to use it to be a teaching for their students, however would be the best for their students. So Shakyamuni used it to teach, well, at least I'm sure he taught many things, but the two that are most obvious right now is that everything, every relationship that begins has an ending, which is a very painful one. Every relationship that begins has an ending. That was one thing he taught in his dying. And the second one was how every single student of his either had already attained nirvana or had laid down the causes and conditions of attaining nirvana. So it's like, what else is there for me to do? But that information is really useful to his students. So again, and I guess maybe a third thing was that death is just a part of life, that this is just the wholeness of our entire being. And now we are focused on, we're an individual knot on Indra's net. And then we just return to Indra's net as a whole. And then we reemerge as a different knot on Indra's net. That's my understanding of the Buddhist concept of living and dying. And so that's why the Zen masters present their own deaths as no big deal. It's, you know, one stood on his head. I mean, it's saying this is no big deal because I'm just going back to the entire being instead of being an individual. And they're both together. Once you're an individual, you're part of the entire being. And then when you're part of the entire being, you become an individual, and it just, and they're interconnected. So there's no difference. They're you know, tied at the hip. And so that I think is the teaching of Zen masters when they get playful around their deaths. But each Zen master is aware that this is a big moment teaching. And so how to use it the best for their students. And some students don't need anything dramatic. You know, they're already filled with grief over their teacher dying. It's a big moment when your teacher dies. I don't know if I'm over it now. So I'm not, you're supposed to not, like, you're not, no attachment, right? That was the first poem that I read to you today. The title was, the second poem. The second poem was Activating the Mind Without Dwelling. And without dwelling means without attachment. So I think we're just about out of time. And I thank you so much for your presence and for your wonderful questions, which are really, for everybody, it's such a gift. It's really an offering. And I want to thank my team, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, for all of the work they do behind the scenes to make these talks possible. And I will see you next week.